Unclean beef eaters were not a part of that small circle. So strict was the Haldas family's usage in this regard that when entertaining, it was their custom to sit politely at table with their guests, but without ever touching any of the food that was heaped before them. So as not to be tempted, they always ate their dinner earlier. And this was what Neil would have liked to do. But with the kitchen boat in disarray, he had to be content with a few handfuls of parched rice soaked in milk.
Welcome to Book Tour. I am Netta Ulaby. Amitav Ghosh has written a sprawling, entrancing new novel set in 19th century Calcutta and on the Bay of Bengal, where a former slave ship is beginning to transport opium and indentured servants. Amitav Ghosh tends in his novel to reconstruct the voices of India's underclass, but in this book, you'll meet Lascars, Rajas, American soldiers, and French runaways. Ghosh is uniquely well-equipped to write novels of Dickensian proportions with cosmopolitan ambitions. He's a former newspaper reporter who holds a doctorate in social anthropology from Oxford University. This reading from Sea of Poppies was recorded on November 2008 at the Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C.
Well, it's really wonderful to be back in this wonderful bookshop. It's one of my favorite bookshops anywhere. This book is about many, many things. It's set in the 1830s. And for me, it began as a book really about the earliest Indians to leave India, who migrated out of India and went abroad, really. These were, of course, indentured workers. The earliest of them went to Mauritius, and the movement to Mauritius started. There was a fair amount of movement even in the 18th century, but it started on a large scale in about the 1830s. This also happens to be the time when opium trade was really expanding, and where under the British East India Company, India became the largest source of opium that history has ever known. And all this opium was in fact really exported to China, forced upon China, one should say. And when the Chinese tried to resist, the British went to war against them. So I'm going to read a little bit. There are three or four characters at this point of the book. One of the central figures in this book is actually the ship itself, which is called the Ibis. And the Ibis is a two-masted Baltimore schooner, which is a very special kind of ship. These were very fast slaving ships, in fact, and they were built as slavers in Baltimore in actually a shipyard called Gardiner's Shipyard, where many of you will remember where Frederick Douglass was attacked and beaten. And in fact, one of the characters in this bit is someone who was an apprentice at Gardiner's Shipyard. He's a young man called Zachary Reed. He's African-American. His father was a white slave owner. His mother was a slave, but he's very white-looking. And in fact, on his way to India, what happens to him is that the Lascars, who are the Asian sailors working on his ship, persuade him to, as it were, impersonate a white man so that they can have him for their officer or first mate. So he's the first mate. He becomes the first mate of the ship called the Ibis. There's another character who's a sailor. His name is Mr. Doughty. He's a pilot. He's been settled in India for many, he's always lived in India. So he's what the English used to call in those days Anglo-Indian. There's also a big opium trader. His name is Mr. Burnham. Well, you'll meet Mr. Burnham. And then there's an Indian aristocrat, Zamindar. His name is Raja Neel Ratan Haldar. And like many, especially Bengali aristocrats of that period, his family has had a close relationship with the opium traders. And in fact, they've grown rich off the opium trade. But it turns out that his father has left him all kinds of debts. And so he's, in fact, on the Ganges in a boat which is called a bajro. These bajros were very palatial boats in Bengal in the 19th century. They were very grand boats, and all the sort of Bengali aristocracy had these boats. So he's run into the Ibis. The Ibis has anchored south of Calcutta, and he's run into the Ibis, and he's decided to invite Mr. Burnham, Zachary Reed, and Mr. Doughty to dinner. So I'm going to read you a little bit about their dinner party. The preparations for dinner had run afoul of some unexpected snags. The boat's lavish sheesh mahal, for one. It had seen little use since the old Raja's time and was found to be in a state of some disrepair when opened up. The chandeliers had lost many of their candle holders, and these had to be replaced by makeshift devices constructed out of bits of string, wood, and even a few strips of coconut fiber. While the results were not unsatisfactory, they took some of the sparkle out of the fixtures and gave them a strangely wind-blown appearance. At the far end of the Sheesh Mahal, behind the dining table, there was a screened alcove meant to accommodate women in parda. From this sequestered vantage point, the old Raja's mistresses had been accustomed to observe his guests. But neglect had taken a toll on the delicately carved observation screen, which was found to have rotted away. A curtain with hastily pierced peepholes was installed in its place at the insistence of Elokeshi, Raja Neelratan Haldar's mistress, for she felt it to be her right to appraise the guests. This in turn inspired a desire for a fuller participation in the evening, so she decided that her three companions would provide some after-dinner entertainment by staging a few dances. But upon inspection, it was found that the floor had warped. To dance barefoot on the crooked boards was to risk a rich crop of splinters. A carpenter had to be summoned to flatten the boards. No sooner was this problem resolved than another arose. The Sheesh Mahal was equipped with a full set of ivory-handled silverware, as well as a complete dinner service imported at great expense from the Swinton Pottery in England. Being reserved for the use of unclean, beef-eating foreigners, these utensils were kept locked in cabinets to prevent the contamination of the household's other crockery. Now, on opening the cabinet, Parimal, the steward, discovered to his shock that many of the plates were missing, as was much of the silverware. There remained just about enough to provide for a dinner for four, but the discovery of the theft created an unpleasant climate of suspicion, which resulted ultimately in an outbreak of internecine fighting on the kitchen boat. After two pikes had ended up with broken noses, Neil was forced to intervene. Although peace was restored, the preparations for the evening were much delayed, and Neil could not be provided with a proper meal in advance of the dinner that would be served to his guests. This was a sore blow, for it meant that Neil would have to fast while his guests feasted. The rules of the Raskhali household were strict in regard to whom the Raja could eat with. Unclean beef-eaters were not a part of that small circle. So strict was the Haldar's family's usage in this regard that when entertaining, it was their custom to sit politely at table with their guests, but without ever touching any of the food that was heaped before them. So as not to be tempted, they always ate their dinner earlier. And this was what Neil would have liked to do. But with the kitchen boat in disarray, he had to be content with a few handfuls of parched rice soaked in milk. Just as the sound of the sunset azan was floating across the water, Neil discovered that he had no more of the fine shanbaf dhotis and abrawan muslin kurtas that he usually wore on public occasions. They had all been sent off to be laundered. He had to content himself with a relatively coarse dosuti dhoti and an allibali kurta. Somewhere in his baggage, Elokeshi found gold-embroidered Lahori jutis for his feet. It was she who led him to his seat in the Sheesh Mahal and draped his shoulders in a shawl of fine Warangal nayansuk with a border of zarbaft brocade. Then, with the ibis's jolly boat approaching, she whisked herself out of sight and went off to preside over her companions' rehearsals. When the guests were shown in, Neil rose ceremonially to his feet. His guest's finery made him self-conscious, and he swirled his brocaded shawl protectively over his chest as he folded his hands together in welcome. "Mr. Burnham, Mr. Doughty, I am most greatly honored to be afforded this privilege." The two Englishmen merely bowed their heads in response, but Zachary startled Neil by moving forward as if to shake hands. He was rescued by Mr. Doughty, who managed to intercept the young American. "Keep your hands to yourself, you gadda of a griffin," whispered the pilot. "Touch him and he'll be off to bathe and we won't be fed till midnight." None of the visitors had been on the Raskhali Bajro before, so they accepted readily when Neil offered them a tour of the public parts of the barge. On the upper deck, they came upon Raj Ratan, his son, who was flying kites by moonlight. Mr. Doughty made a harumphing sound when the boy was introduced. "Is this little rascal your upper Raja, Raja Neil Ratan?" "The upper Raja, yes," Neil nodded. "My sole issue and heir. The tender fruit of my loin, as your poets might say." "Ah, your little green mango." Mr. Doughty shot a wink in Zachary's direction. "And if I may be so bold as to ask, would you describe your loin as the stem or the branch?" Neil gave him a frosty glare. "Why, sir," he said coldly, "it is the tree itself." Back in the Sheesh Mahal, a bottle of champagne was waiting in a balti of muddy river water. Neil could not help reflecting on what a mercy it was that his ancestors had excluded wine and liquor from the list of things that could not be shared with unclean foreigners. It would be all but impossible, surely, to deal with them if not for their drink. He would have liked another glass of Simkin, but he noticed from the corner of his eye that Parimal was making signs to indicate that dinner was ready. He took the folds of his dhoti into his hands. "Gentlemen, I am being given to believe that our repast has been readied." As he rose to his feet, the Sheesh Mahal's velvet curtain was swept back to reveal a large polished table set in the English fashion with knives, forks, plates, and wine glasses. Two immense candelabra stood at either end, illuminating the settings. In the center was an arrangement of wilted water lilies, piled together in such profusion that almost nothing could be seen of the vase that held them. There was no food on the table, for meals in the Raskhali household were served in the Bengali fashion, in successive courses. Neil had arranged the seating so that he would have Mr. Burnham across the table from him, with Zachary and Mr. Doughty to his left and right respectively. There was a bearer behind each chair, as was the custom. Now, on arriving at the table, there was a long pause during which Neil and his guests stayed on their feet, waiting for their chairs to be pushed forward. Catching Parimal's eye, Neil realized that the boatman had not been told about this part of the ceremony. They, in turn, were waiting for the guests to come to them. Clearly, they were under the impression that the diners were to be seated at a distance of several feet from the table. And how indeed were they to know, it occurred to Neil to wonder. The chairs and tables belonged in much closer proximity. In the interim, one of the young boatmen took the initiative and gave Mr. Doughty's elbow a helpful tap to indicate that his chair was empty and waiting to be occupied, some 3 feet to the rear. Neil saw the pilot reddening and intervened hastily in Bengali, ordering the boatmen to bring their chairs closer. The command was so sharply uttered that the youngest of the boatmen, a boy who happened to be attending upon Zachary, brought his chair forward in a startled rush, as though he were pushing a dinghy down a mud bank. The lip of the chair caught Zachary from behind, scooping him up and delivering him to the table, breathless but otherwise unharmed. Although he apologized profusely, Neil was pleased to see that Zachary was more amused than offended by the incident. In the short time they had spent together, the young American had made a considerable impression on him, as much for the innate elegance of his person as for the reserve of his bearing. "Will you be sailing home soon?" Neil asked. "Why, no, sir," Zachary responded. "The Ibis is bound first for the Mauritius. If we make good time, we may sail to China later in the year." "I see." This recalled to Neil's mind his original purpose in hosting this meal, which was to discover whether there was any immediate prospect of a change in his chief creditor's fortunes. He turned to Mr. Burnham. "There is an improvement, then, in the situation in China." Mr. Burnham answered with a shake of his head. "No, Raja Neil Ratan, no. Truth to tell, the situation has worsened considerably, to the point where there is serious talk of war. Indeed, that may well be the reason for the Ibis's voyage to China." "A war?" said Neil in astonishment. "But I have heard nothing about a war with China." "I'm sure you haven't," said Mr. Burnham, with a thin smile. "Why, indeed, should a man like you concern yourself with such matters? You have more than enough to occupy you, I'm sure, with all your palaces and zananas and budgeros." Neil knew that he was being sneered at, and his hackles rose, but he was saved from an intemperate response by the timelier appearance of the first course, a steaming soup. Mr. Doughty permitted himself an indulgent smile. "Do I smell duck?" he said, sniffing the air. Although glad of the interruption, Neil had not forgotten Mr. Burnham's dismissive jibes about his preoccupations. He was convinced now that the shipowner was exaggerating in order to persuade him of the extent of his firm's losses. Taking care to keep his voice even, he said, "You will no doubt be surprised to know, Mr. Burnham, that I have been at some pains to be keeping myself informed, yet I know nothing about this war you speak of." "Well, then, it falls to me to inform you, sir," said Mr. Burnham, "that of late the officials in Canton have been moving forcefully to end the inflow of opium into China. It is the unanimous opinion of all of us who do business there that the mandarins cannot be allowed to have their way. To end the trade would be ruinous for firms like mine, but also for you and indeed for all of India." "Ruinous?" said Neil mildly. "But surely we can offer China something more useful than opium?" "Would that it were so," said Mr. Burnham, "but it is not. To put the matter simply, there is nothing they want from us. They've got it into their heads that they have no use for our products and manufactures. But we, on the other hand, can't do without their tea and their silks. If not for opium, the drain of silver from Britain and her colonies would be simply too great to sustain. The next course appeared, and it consisted of fledgling chickens that had been cooked whole. "I'll be damned if it isn't a roast of sudden death," cried Mr. Doughty in delight. Neil stared at the bird on his plate in glum resignation. He was suddenly very hungry, and had he not been in plain view of his retainers, he would certainly have set upon the chicken. But he distracted himself instead by belatedly raising his glass to Mr. Burnham. "To you, sir," he said, "and your successes in China." Mr. Burnham smiled. "It wasn't easy, I can tell you," he said, "especially in the early days, when the mandarins were somewhat less than amenable." "Really?" Not having given much thought to commerce, Neil had imagined that the traffic in opium enjoyed official approval in China. This seemed only natural, since in Bengal the trade was not merely sanctioned, but monopolized by the British authorities under the seal of the East India Company. "You amaze me, Mr. Burnham," he said. "Is the sale of opium frowned on by the Chinese authorities, then?" "I'm afraid so," said Mr. Burnham. "Trafficking in opium has been illegal there for some time. But they've never made a tamasher about it in the past. Their mandarins and chantoks always got their 10% dasturis and were glad to shut their eyes to it. The only reason they're making a fuss now is that they want a bigger share of the profits." "It's simple," Mr. Doughty announced, chewing on a wing. "The long tails have to be given a taste of the lati." "I'm afraid I have to agree, Doughty," said Mr. Burnham, nodding. "A timely dose of chastisement is always to the good." "So you're convinced then," said Neil, "that your government will go to war?" "It may well come to that, alas," said Mr. Burnham. "Britain has been nothing if not patient, but there's a limit to everything." Now suddenly Neil made a discovery that shocked him to his core. His eyes having strayed to the wilted water lilies at the center of the table, he realized to his utter horror that the flowers were sitting not in a vase, as he had thought, but in an old porcelain chamber pot. Evidently, the Bajra's present generation of boatmen had forgotten the function and history of this vessel, but Neil remembered very well that it had been purchased expressly for the use of an elderly district magistrate whose intestines had been sorely beset by worms. Stifling an exclamation of disgust, Neil tore his eyes away and cast about for a subject that would keep his guests distracted. When one such suggested itself, he uttered a cry in which a lingering trace of revulsion could still be heard. "But, Mr. Burnham, are you saying the British Empire will go to war to force opium on China?" This elicited an instantaneous response from Mr. Burnham, who placed his wine glass forcefully on the table. "Evidently, you have mistaken my meaning, Raja Neel Ratan," he said. "The war, when it comes, will not be for opium. It will be for a principle, for freedom, for the freedom of trade and for the freedom of the Chinese peoples. Free trade is a right conferred on man by God, and his principles apply as much to opium as to any other article of trade. More so, perhaps, since in its absence, many millions of natives would be denied the lasting advantages of British influence." Here Zachary broke in. "How so, Mr. Burnham?" "For the simple reason, Reed," said Mr. Burnham patiently, "that British rule in India could not be sustained without opium. That is all there is to it, and let us not pretend otherwise. You are no doubt aware that in some years, the company's annual gains from opium are almost equal to the entire revenue of your own country, the United States of America. Do you imagine that British rule would be possible in this impoverished land if it were not for this source of wealth? And if we reflect on the benefits that British rule has conferred upon India, does it not follow that opium is this land's greatest blessing? Does it not follow that it is our God-given duty to confer these benefits upon others?" Neil could not help saying in a tone of pious rebuke now, "Does it not trouble you, Mr. Burnham, to invoke God in the service of opium?" "Not in the slightest," said Mr. Burnham, stroking his beard. "One of my countrymen has put the matter very simply. Jesus Christ is free trade, and free trade is Jesus Christ." Truer words, I believe, were never spoken. If it is God's will that opium be used as an instrument to open China to his teachings, then so be it. For myself, I confess I can see no reason why an Englishman should abet the Manchu tyrant in depriving the people of China of this miraculous substance. "Do you mean opium?"
I certainly do, said Mr. Burnham tartly. Well, let me ask you, sir, would you like to return to such a time when men had to have their teeth pulled and their limbs sawn off without benefit of any palliative to ease the pain?
Why, no, said Neil with a shudder. I certainly wouldn't.
I thought not, said Mr. Burnham. So you would do well to bear in mind, sir, that it would be well nigh impossible to practice modern medicine or surgery without such chemicals as morphine, codeine, and narcotine, and these are but a few of the blessings derived from opium. In the absence of gripe water, our children would not sleep. And what would our ladies, why, our beloved queen herself, do without laudanum? Why, one might even say that it is opium that has made this age of progress and industry possible. Without it, the streets of London would be thronged with coughing, sleepless, incontinent multitudes. And if we consider all this, is it not apposite to ask if the Manchu tyrant has any right to deprive his helpless subjects of the advantages of progress? Do you think it pleases God to see us conspiring with that tyrant in depriving such a great number of people of this amazing gift? But Mr. Burnham, Neil persisted, is it not true that there is a great deal of addiction and intoxication in China? Surely such afflictions are not pleasing to our Creator. This nettled Mr. Burnham. These ills you mention, sir, he replied, are merely aspects of the fallen nature of man. Should you ever happen to walk through the rookeries of London, Raja Neil Rutton, you will see for yourself that there is as much addiction and intoxication in the gin shops of the entire empire's capital as there is in the dens of Canton. Are we then to raise every tavern in the city, ban wine from our tables and whiskey from our parlours, deprive our sailors and soldiers of their daily dose of grog? And these measures being enacted, would addiction disappear and intoxication vanish? And would every member of parliament bear the blame for every fatality should their efforts fail? The answer is no. No, because the antidote for addiction lies not in bans enacted by parliaments and emperors, but in the individual conscience, in every man's awareness of his personal responsibility and his fear of God. As a Christian nation, this is the single most important lesson we can offer to China. And I have no doubt that the message would be welcomed by the people of that unfortunate country were they not prevented from hearing it by the cruel despot who holds sway over them. It is tyranny alone that is to blame for China's degeneracy, sir. Merchants like myself are but the servants of free trade, which is as immutable as God's commandments. Mr. Burnham paused to pop a crisp Felita pup in his mouth. And I might add in this regard that I do not think it sits well on a Raja of Raskhali to moralize on the subject of opium. And why not, said Neil, steeling himself for the affront that was sure to follow. Pray explain, Mr. Burnham. Why not? Well, for the very good reason that everything you possess is paid for by opium. This bajaro, your houses, this food. Do you think you could afford any of this on the revenues of your estate and your half-starved coolie farmers? No, sir, it's opium that's given you all of this. But I would not go to war for it, sir, said Neil, in a tone that matched Mr. Burnham's in its sharpness. And I do not believe the Empire will either. You must not imagine that I am unaware of the part that Parliament plays in your country. Parliament, Mr. Burnham laughed. Parliament will not know of it until the war is over. Be assured, sir, that if such matters were left to Parliament, there would be no Empire. Hear, hear, said Mr. Doughty, raising his glass. Truer words were never spoken. So I'll stop there. It's such a wonderful thing to be here at this very sort of historic moment in American in America, really, where really that's... I was writing this through what I think of as the long, dark night of the Bush years. And, it's so strange when one looks back on that now, those years, especially 2004, 2005, it seems so far away, but that was when I was writing this book, and it was extraordinary. That was when I was writing about the Opium War, and, all the stuff that Mr. Burnham says, I didn't make it up. I don't think you can make that stuff up, you know? What happened was that when the British merchants started pressurizing the British government, just like Halliburton in Iraq, the entire Opium War was planned by a company
So they planned it. They went to London. They applied pressure on Lord Palmerston, who was then the Prime Minister. And as a part of the process of applying this pressure, they actually compiled a series of essays written by opium merchants. And these were the arguments they made. The empire is not sustainable without opium, which is in fact true, because the opium trade literally stopped in 1920, and the opium did not, and the empire did not long outlast it. They made the argument that the main argument was free trade. They said this is all in service of free trade. You have to remember that this was the period, really, when Adam Smith's ideas were first taking hold amongst a populace, when it was first becoming, as it were, an ideology. You know, it was the ideology that's replacing mercantilism and so on. And merchants become its propagators. And these merchants, they use this argument all the time, free trade, that free trade is sanctioned by God, that it's the British Empire's duty is to implement the laws of God, which is the laws of free trade. You know, so this is exactly the period, when first we have this idea taking shape that, the free market is a kind of God unto itself. You know, that it's some sort of inscrutable being whose operation is not open, really, to human intervention, And yet, it was so strange to be writing this book at exactly the moment when you hear those arguments, what is it, 170 years later, being said. I mean, this Mr. Burnham and these people were really the neocons of that age. I mean, you have to remember, Mr. Burnham's own history, as was the history of many opium traders, is that he began his career as a slave trader. And remember how the slave trade was justified, because the slave trade had very powerful and very articulate defenders who said that the slave trade is a very necessary thing because it's delivering Africans into freedom. You know, that was actually the argument made, that you're taking them away from the dark tyranny of Africa and delivering them into freedom. That was the nature of the argument. So, I mean, it's literally, that is the first period where you see, people making these arguments where, the night appears to be day, and the whole world is, there's this kind of alternative universe which becomes, which comes to command incredible political power, And I do think, going ahead, really, that there will come a day when, when I was taught history and the early modern history and so on, the French Revolution was considered to be, as it were, the critical moment. But I think there will come a time, really, when, as we go ahead, it's really this period, 1838, 1839, 1840, the start of the Opium Wars, will come to be seen as the inauguration of a period when really the world's principal superpowers made war in the name of free markets and free trade and so on. And there itself, is this huge sort of astonishing question mark, which, you can't figure out what is the double think that is happening in these guys' heads. I mean, there they are talking about free markets, free trade. The free market is a sort of God's immutable commandment. Yet they can invoke the support of an army on its behalf. And where does the army come from? I mean, the army is deployed by a government, So there you are.
I was wondering if you can talk a little bit about how you put yourself in the frame of mind to be able to write a story in a time that's so far in the past.
Yes, that's a very good question. How does one put oneself in that frame of mind? And is one's representation of it ever accurate? I don't know. I think one makes it up. One thing that really helps is just steeping yourself in the books of the period, in the writing of the period, in memoirs of that period. This book for me is really very much sort of influenced by America, because while I've been in America, I've had the good fortune, really, to have lived mainly within African-American neighborhoods. So African-American history has been something which has become very, very important to me. And especially reading, 18th century African-American history, one of the things that you see which is so interesting is the slave narratives. You know, if you think of the narratives of Olauda Equiano, or even the later narratives of Frederick Douglass and so on, there's a fairly rich tradition of the slave narrative. You know, I mean, so that we have several collections of slave narratives. Some of them were oral histories recorded later, but even written slave narratives we do possess. Now, you have to remember that India, the India that I'm writing about, this period, the 19th century India, India became to the 19th century what Africa was to the 17th and 18th centuries, that it was really a sort of enormous pool of captive labor, you know, which was used in the plantations throughout the islands across the Indian Ocean and the Atlantic. The extraordinary thing is that in this enormous migration of Indians to these places, we have no narratives. None of them wrote narratives. And it's an extraordinary kind of absence in the history, you know. And it's really extraordinary because, you know, these people who went to these islands founded what was eventually to become one of the world's most extraordinary literary traditions, you know. If you think of Sir V.S. Naipaul, if you think of Sam Selvan and that great tradition of Caribbean writing and, you know, so much of it is rooted in that experience. But the writers, when they're reflecting on their ancestors' experience there, these are all stories of arrival. You know, they're talking about their ancestors fitting in into the circumstances that they found. They're talking about the world that they discovered, you know, in Trinidad or, you know, whatever that world was. What interests me, and I think this interests me partly from having read a lot of American writing, is that American writing, like American immigrant writing, like the writing of most sort of settler cultures, is really always a literature of arrival. You know, even if you think of all the great Jewish writers and so on who were writing in the 30s and 40s and so on, they're never writing about about the Europe that they left. It's always about the America that they find. You know, it's about the streets of New York, or it's about the countryside that they're going into. What interests me, and this is, I think, because I look out at the world as an Indian, you know, is the moment of departure. You know, what does it mean for these people to leave? And it's the specificity of that moment of departure which really interested me. So in that sense, you know, to come back to your question, I mean, having sort of steeped myself very much within the sort of whole tradition of the slave narrative, I really began to think about this, that, you know, what does it mean, you know, for people who are leaving India to be going into this diaspora?
I first have to apologize to you. I'm in the middle of reading your book, but I came to it second. I read the book of your competitors for the Booker, Adiga, the White Tiger, which is about the India of today, and which is the main theme is corruption, or the government extracting resources from everybody inside and not giving anything to people in return. Now, your book is a complete flip of the situation. This is the businessmen who control everything, can do pretty much, there's no corruption because there's nobody standing. Oh, well, they have to bribe the Chinese officials, I suppose. But in the Indian context, this was a sort of an open place for businessmen to do anything, including getting their government to go to war on their behalf. So how do you see that contrast?
That's very hard for me to respond to because, there's like a century, 170 years in between. And as I was just saying, you know, I've been so much immersed in this period that it's really what's particular about this moment that interests me, really, rather than a moment of comparison. If one were to try and create the sort of historical genealogy of contemporary India, it would be a very complicated thing. Yes.
I wanted to ask, is this the long passage or whatever it's referred
little
to?
Little passage, yeah.
The little passage. Is that a narrative? Is that discussed in India? Is that talked about? Is that part of family lore at all? Like the long passage would be in America, in here, in the States.
See, that's one of the specificities that really interests me. I mean, I grew up, when I was growing up in India, this aspect of our diaspora just didn't exist for us. You know, I mean, it just didn't exist, you know, at a societal level, at a political level, at an imaginative level. It was like these people had just been, and one part of it, and I think one very important part of it, is that when people left India, as opposed to leaving, say, Europe, or say when Arabs leave, and Arabs are another great sort of migratory nation, you know, when they leave the Middle East, there's not a sense that you're cutting off your roots. But in India, this was a very powerful sense that if you leave, then you lose caste, you lose your standing in the community, and you become you're thrown out. And the sea was known as the Kala Pani, the black water. And once you crossed it, you know, you were never really fully taken back into your own communities and caste. I'm talking about the very sort of traditional communities from which these people actually came. So, you know, we have so many accounts written by migrants. When they go back, you know, just think of it. This dirt poor guy, I mean, he's literally been sold off by his parents because they can't afford to keep him. He goes off to Mauritius. His whole family lives off the little money he sends back from Mauritius. Then one day, he's, you know, all those years he's thinking of home. He goes back to his home. And his family, you know, it's not that they're unhappy to see him, but he just can't go inside the house. He can't eat with them. He can't sit at the table with them. On the threshold, he can sit, and they'll sit and talk to him and be very friendly. But, you know, he's completely lost caste. He can't go back inside. So, you know, it's a very peculiar kind of poignancy that I think these people were facing. And, you know, this was, of course, I'm talking about the 19th century. It was a long time ago. It wasn't the case, you know, later in the later diaspora, say from the 1860s, 70s onwards, didn't face this issue quite so much. And it is a fact that, you know, 25% of the people who went into the indenture returned to India. But what's also very interesting is that a great number of them went back. You know, they went on these repeated journeys, you know, back and forth.
Yes. Amitav, I enjoyed your book thoroughly. I read it over the summer, and it was like a sumptuous feast. And I particularly enjoyed the songs, the Bhojpuri songs that you have with their translations dotted throughout the book. I almost said the movie, but it felt like a movie. And my question is, I have two questions, really. One is the people on the ship, many of them were what you've called Girmithias. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it correctly.
Yes.
Girmithias. Can you tell us a little bit about the historical accuracy of these people? Like, how did these people exist, and what was this institution of Girmithias? And my second question is, could you also tell us about the remaining two parts of this trilogy?
I can certainly answer the first part of that very easily. The word Girmithia is actually a corruption of the English word agreement, which was shortened to Girmit, because the indentured workers had to sign an agreement, you know. So that's what it came from. Everyone had to sign. So later, within the diaspora, people appropriated this word and called themselves Girmithias because of having taken, because of having been, having signed the Girmit. There's a fair amount of research on the early years of this, you know, of the diaspora. We have very, because, you know, in Mauritius, there's a wonderful institute called the Mahatma Gandhi Institute, which has preserved every single piece of paper relating to this. And so we have all the indenture agreements and so on. So we know, actually, it's I mean, the voluminous records. So we know the caste background, we know the ages, we know the you know, we know the social backgrounds, the districts of many, if not you know, of the Girmithias. And it's interesting that they were from a variety of castes. It's not at all that they were all from certain castes. I mean, there were Brahmins, there were Rajputs, there were Koiris, there were Telis, there were all sorts of caste groups were involved, and a very large number of them were Bengalis. You know, because the it was funneled through Calcutta, many Bengalis joined in. There were many people. Later, it was expanded. There were many, many people from the south as well. But in this early period of the migration, they were mainly from North Bihar.
I was astonished by your familiarity with the African American slave literature of Middle Passage. And since there was no Indian narrative coming out of the diaspora, then your book then must be an imagination, an exercise of imagination. How much do you feel the African American experience and literature influenced how you imagined these voices on this ship and making this translation?
It influenced me enormously, really. Say, especially reading Olauda Equiano, but even though Olauda Equiano is said by some to be apocryphal, to be an apocryphal text, nobody really knows. But the tone of Equiano's work really, really influenced me because, you know, again, as you know from having read Equiano, that it's not a monotonal text. You know, it's a very varied and very nuanced kind of text, which includes a lot of his own successes as well. Then again, I found actually a very interesting memoir by an African American who'd been a sailor in the 1850s, his manner of writing was also something that interested me very much, because especially one of the things that interests me so much about those texts is the sort of experiment in language that is happening all the time. You know. Occasionally, the attempts to repress, as it were, the language that they perhaps spoke, amongst themselves, but also the way in which that language pours into the sailor language, you know. And I think that is another sense in which this book has been very much influenced by, those texts, which is that I love that those interstitial languages, the ways in which, you know, words like okay and so on are appropriated from Africa and become okay, dude, all these words, which are 18th century words, you know, beautiful 18th century words which come to be, somehow get a gloss of the new. And again, 19th century English was so profoundly influenced by Asian words, you know. I mean, even in the bit I read, you'll have seen that there are many words which are not familiar, yet all of them are in the Oxford English Dictionary. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. For more readings and discussions like this one, visit npr.org/booktour.